Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're talking about the Kingdom of God. And we put up a number of web pages in the last couple of weeks at preparingyou.com, and we let everybody in the network know about them, and different people have been contributing and assisting in the process of bringing information to you. One of the web pages we put up was James Scott's web page, and that's just what we titled it, James Scott. He wrote a book about the art of not being governed, and it was about the people who lived in a mountainous area of Asia that was actually incorporated into seven different Asian countries. But the people in this area of Zambia do not want to have anything to do with those governments. They are separate from the governments as much as they can be, and they used to be a lot more separate, and they're actually in those places to avoid the toxicity of governments, the social toxicity that often comes with government. With government comes heavy taxes, corvée systems of statutory labor, where you, a portion of your labor is automatically confiscated by the government. They used to actually round up work gangs. Now they just kind of have electronic ways of taking a portion of your earnings out of your pocket before you even see them. And it's a lot less painful that way, but the same result. Every time you take a dime or an hour of somebody's time, you've taken an hour of their life. You're literally taking a bite out of them. That was forbidden in the Ten Commandments. It was forbidden in Christianity. It was forbidden in Judaism. It was forbidden back in the days of Abraham. And it, even if you go back to the ancient Egyptian laws, you couldn't do that. But in all the cases, Judaism today, you got the nation of Israel. There's thousands, I guess millions of Jews who are in opposition against the nation of Israel because they say it's not really Jewish state, it's a Zionist state. And actually, if you read the Torah, you'll see that, you know, they have in Israel, they have a heavy progressive income tax, so does every other country. They don't even have clad coin like we have in the United States. They just have iron coin. They had it even before us, which is unjust weights and measures. It's a stamp value that has no value. It's an imposed value by government. And all this is fine. I have no objection to people going that way if they want to go that way. But what I am in the business of doing is telling you what's going to happen if you go that way. Kind of like Samuel 8. You know, if you decide to go that way and create a government that can tell you what money is worth and give you like the Spartans, you only could have lead coin in Sparta. You couldn't have gold and silver coin. It was considered an enemy of the state to give people wealth. You had to keep them impoverished and enslaved and doing the bidding of the Spartans, who were a small minority in the population, and everybody else had to work for them. And if you showed any sign of not wanting to work for the Spartans, they just killed you. I mean, they were a totally fascist state, the Spartans. And extremely so. And they did finally incorporate some of the people and say, well, we're going to actually need more manpower to win this battle. So we will teach you how to fight. And we will give you arms. And we will bring you into the army and all this kind of stuff. And they taught them. And they fought well. And they were finally able to defeat the enemy. And they were going to give them their reward. They took them up on the mountain to give them their reward. And they dressed them all in white linen and everything. And then they killed them. Because they couldn't afford to have the people, the general population, know how to defend themselves. They had to keep the people weak. So since Lycurgus and back in the days of Nimrod and throughout history, there have been elements of societies created by men that want to keep the people weak and dependent and subservient. And there has always been people that have fled to the mountains, to the forests, to remain free. And they often had to work harder. They were usually healthier. They were much more independent, and they had lots of different ways to govern themselves without ruling over each other. I gave the story in the book, That Kingdom Come, of Hermann the German, who went by a couple of different names. He was Teuton, and he was actually an exchange student who grew up part of the time in Rome, served in the Roman military, understood Roman tactics, and when Rome was marching into the area of Germanicus and going to assert their authority, they weren't going to be total dictatorial, but they were bringing in roads to make money. They were bringing in roads to bring trade. They were bringing in roads to march their armies down so that they could eventually, usually, you know, like if they went into the area, most centurions never pulled a sword in battle throughout the history of centurions. They were builders. They would go into an area and build, harbors. And then they would charge for the use of the harbors. And if you brought in those harbors, then you had to build roads. And then you charged for the access to the roads. And then you had to build trading centers, marketplaces. And then, and so they were builders, and they would do it for profit. There was a reason why they came to an area. They thought, well, we can make some money here. That there was a financial motivation, and that wasn't necessarily bad in itself. That was kind of good in itself. They also carried swords that if you tried to steal what they built, they would defend it. And a lot of times they were welcomed into an area. They would go and mine an area, and everybody would benefit. Rome rose to greatness with the free enterprise system. They were totally not a socialist state at first. They were hardworking, industrious, law-oriented people. They had a strong understanding of law. I write in the book, That Kingdom Comes, where Pompey is asked to come and help one of the individuals who claimed that he had the right to be king in Judea. It was Aristobulus and Hyrcanus. And they were battling each other. They were cousins, and they were battling each other for the right to sit on the throne, because there was money in that, power in that. And Aristobulus appealed to Pompey to come and help, and offered him money, gold, if he would come. And he didn't come himself. He sent another general. And then as soon as that general showed up with a little bit of an army, Hyrcanus backed away and Aristobulus sat on the throne. And Aristobulus didn't like some of the stuff that the general was doing. So he complained to Pompey, and Pompey himself came. And when Pompey himself came, the first thing, this gives you a picture of the Roman mentality, at least up to the time of Pompey, that began to diminish and had already begun to diminish even before Pompey. But the first thing they wanted to see was the Torah. They wanted to see the laws of the place, because that's how they would know what is just for that place. I mean, they had a basic understanding of justice, but they weren't coming in and just writing, you guys all have to go by Roman law. They understood that people had a right to govern themselves. Romans thought very highly of the right to govern yourself. And so they weren't just coming in and dictatorially saying, everybody's got to do things our way. And when he read the law and listened to the arguments, he realized that Aristobulus did not have the best claim. And he withdrew his support of Aristobulus and offered his support to Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus refused the support of Pompey, because in the law, for that place in the Torah. They weren't to make treaties and agreements and apply to other people for beneficial aid where there might be strings attached. And so, but Rome was there. Rome was going to build harbors, and so they were allowed to stay. But the government from then on really wasn't simply a byproduct of the Roman government. Now, this Pompeii was long before Jesus Christ, and through the process of years, eventually Octavius has a civil war within the Roman people, and at Philippi, that he finally defeated those who were fighting for the Republic, and the emperor won. And that's kind of like your Star Wars deal, where you have the Republic and you have this emperor trying to seize control. Well, Octavius was that emperor. He was the first emperor of Rome, and he seized control and established several new offices. And we've talked about that and have articles on that. But the point is that people were fleeing these governments because they know that they would centralize power. Rome rose to greatness with free enterprise. But under Octavius and other emperors that came along, Caligula and the rest of them, it became more and more a socialist state. And it was the rise, you watch the rise of the welfare state in Rome. And the taxation of those who were achieving and establishing businesses and making income and bringing wealth into Rome, they began to tax them and began to give the money away. They gave the money away to the poor or the lower than middle class people. The problem was immediately more and more people began to fall within the poor range and less within the wealthy range. And people began to actually leave Rome and go other places where they would not be taxed as much. But there wasn't a lot of other places to go because Rome controlled a great deal. There was other countries that didn't really have quite the centralization of imperial power, and people did go to those. People went up north. Actually, you know, we've done whole shows talking about as Rome burned, and the Emperor Nero stole the money out of the coffers of the Roman treasury and put them on ships, moved them, and then eventually moved them north. And he took with him a Judean bride, and they went and lived in valleys way to the north with their own little army and their own little protection, and got completely out of the imperial thing and had children and were wealthy people up there. You could do that because Rome's influence, they talk about Rome occupying Great Britain and Rome occupying Gaul and all this stuff. Well, they did, but never really very far from their roads and harbors. So there were always the foothills that people could go up into and the mountains could go up into and remain. If you could keep a consolidated group around you and a society around you, you could remain rather safe in these places from these imperial governments that would come in and try to incorporate you into the state, enfranchise your rights, and start subjugating you to the will of the Darth Vaders of the world. These people who want to have control and are absolutely willing to alter the agreement even after the fact. So anyway, this has been the plague of man's history, and James Scott was writing this book, The Art of, being basically free from this government control, being free from government. And what it was what societies did in these remote areas to govern themselves in such a way that the government couldn't come in. And of course, Hermann the German rallied the forces of Germany, the Teutons, where 1,200 Teutons came against, 12,000 Teutons came against 15,000 Roman troops and defeated them to the man. And he was able to bring these people to this massive army overnight, very little time. I mean, the Romans were already on the road and coming. But he was able to muster them because of the fact that they had a system of religion in Germany that allowed them to do this. Now, how could religion do this? Well, it's not religion like you think today. It's not what they think about God. It's what they think about each other. It was how they perform their duty to the gods, their God, and each other. And, you know, they made a god out of courage and a god out of generosity and a god even out of forgiveness. And, you know, they put names on them and all this kind of stuff. But what they were really trying to do is create a religious system where social virtue was admired and held up as a value, not only to the individual, but to society in general. And so what they did was they got together in the same kind of pattern of tens, hundreds, and thousands, or 144,000s, and they, this cell group deal where you got together with 9, 10, 12 other families, and you picked a minister, and he got together with other ministers like him, picked by those same kinds of families. And the people literally organized themselves into kind of a network similar to what you see with a military army, you know, where you have platoons and companies and battalions. They had all that organized, but based on welfare of society. You know, if somebody has a need, if somebody gets injured, or somebody, you know, a husband dies and the leaves a widow and small children, or somebody gets sick and they need help, and they would go to the priests of those societies, and they would have resources. They could go to the people and say, you know, so and so, who is a good man and had a great father and all this kind of stuff, he needs help. Can we get some assistance to him? Somebody robs him, they form a posse and go after the posse. Like in Silas Marner, when somebody robbed Silas and he came in and said, somebody stole my money. They broke into my house and they stole my money. And everybody went out looking for the guy. And they didn't find him for many years, but eventually found that the guy had fallen into a pit. And they found his money and they restored it. And the people did that. Not the police, not the government, but the people. And that's what you do in these societies because you don't have a government. Anyway, what happened was he defeated the Romans when they first came up. And then because of this, he was received lots of gifts and lots of the spoils. There wasn't a lot of spoils because the way in which they defeated him. And the next time the Romans came, he wanted to defeat them, but he didn't want to do it in the same tactic that worked so well. He wanted to do it so that he would end up with some of the treasure. And there was a tactic that they used up there where they chased everybody into the bogs, and then the bogs kind of swallowed them up. But it also swallowed up their armor and their treasury and the coins in their pocket. And he wanted to corner them, defeat them, and then be able to go through their pockets and get their armor and get all their treasury and everything. Because they came up with gold. Because in their building projects, they would have to pay people. And that's one of the reasons why they were accepted. They would bring industry. You know, kind of the ugly American kind of thing. We would bring industry and people say, we want the Americans in here. They build factories. They get people employed. And we want them in here. And then we get them in here and then we start messing with their government. Start saying, well, we don't really like that guy. We like this guy. And so we want you to put this guy in power so that we keep our companies there, our factories there, and keep our foreign aid coming in. And so people do it. You know, the powers that be in that country will assassinate their own people to make sure that the guy that the Americans want gets in. Well, after a while, we're now losing that influence. They can say, well, we can do business with the Chinese instead of the Americans. So now we really are the ugly Americans, although they don't realize it, that Chinese are harder to deal with than us. Just ask the people in Vietnam. But anyway, the point is there's always been an element of society that was trying to avoid this centralization of government. And the Bible is very much in advocacy of that. And I pointed out in earlier shows on the same subject that Abraham left Ur, went out into the wilderness, out into the desert, didn't form a city-state, but formed something that got the people to work together. And it had to do with these altars, whatever these altars were. Now, we draw pictures of altars, piles of stone, and they're killing sheep on them and burning them up, and somehow or other this unites all the people. And everybody goes, oh, yeah, let's risk our life to save Abraham because he showed us how to burn up sheep. Well, the reality is they weren't burning up sheep. That's not what it says. That's what the Pharisees would tell you that it says, but the Essenes of that day, they know it didn't say that. They know that those altars were altars of stone, and those stones were living men. They were the same word for a gathering of stones as a gathering or council of men. And those men were those 1 in 10 that would be chosen to take care of the social welfare of society. So you didn't just buddy up to your buddy who's going to help you. You buddied up to this congregation that was connected to 9 other congregations. And when you gave to this minister who could use the funds in the local congregation, but he could also use the funds in other congregations if there was a need. And other congregations of congregations if there was a need even farther away. People always talk about the early church being home churches. They didn't build cathedrals. They didn't build these big buildings. They were home churches. Well, they were, but those homes were connected because they were following the same pattern as the Teutons, the tens, hundreds, and thousands. And you see it all over the early church, in Germany, in what is now France, was Gaul back then. You see it in Ireland. You see it in Great Britain with their tithings. 10 men get together, pick a man, and they would meet on the full moon of every month. And why? Because they had to exchange information, know what's going on with these other men. And this united the 10 families in your local little village, or 20 or 30 families in a local little village, with 20 or 30 or 300 families in villages all over the county. Because they were connected to this network of ministers who had no way of taxing you. They didn't tax you, but you gave to them, and they would come and they would say, so-and-so needs help. This community over here needs help. And they would gather together and help. A local community here in Silver Lake, 25 miles to the north, they had a fire in a meeting hall, and people were, you know, crashing. The hall was upstairs, and they were crashing out through the windows and going out on a porch roof in order to escape the fire, and the porch roof collapsed. Many people died. Many people were injured. Many people were burned. And somebody jumped on a horse and rode. I think they eventually got all the way to Lakeview and just calling for help. They had to change horses at different ranches. That's a long way, 75 miles. And the very next day, people were showing up with buckboards and blankets and bandages and food and help. Came from communities all over. Wasn't the government coming. It was people coming. People coming to the aid of people. Because there wasn't much government out here then. Now I'm afraid everybody would wait for the government. And then probably a little less in this community because we're still a long ways out. But if you were in the cities, the guys on the next block ain't coming over to help you. They might come over, but they're probably going to rob you. You know, rioters or whatever, looters. Because we've been weakened as a society. We have been taken down a notch or two from the humanity that made us a great people at one time. And so, what do we do about it? What could we do about it? What should we do about it? What would Abraham do? What would Jesus do? If we can use that analogy. The book he wrote was The Art of Not Being Governed. And the reason why is that people learn to govern themselves. To not be governed, it was a certain element of social virtue was required. Now, some of that social virtue could be courage. Like I said, with the Teutons, they made a god out of courage. Generosity. You know, they would have festivals, and the more you brought to that festival, the higher up you were considered. And they organized, like I said, in the tens, hundreds, and thousands. They picked a minister, a priest, they called him. You know, the Jews called him a Kohen. But this guy was to receive the offerings. Whenever they had the festival, Feast of Tabernacles, Feast of, you know, which is the Feast of Tents, or Pentecost, you were to come there, and they would party, they would have lots of food, and everybody would be sharing, they'd probably have music, they would have all these kinds of things. We have our fall festival, actually is going to be a little early this year, the end of August, and we call it the Burning Bush Festival. But it's basically the same idea, and we have another festival going on in the middle of the country this spring here, actually not too many days. Just join the network and they'll give you the particulars. But the idea that you come together, somebody puts these on. They do a lot of work to arrange to have bathrooms and facilities and camping areas and all this kind of stuff. And they kind of get invaded for a week or so. When everybody goes away, that person should feel enriched. All the expense they went to, they should be compensated for. What often happens is that, you know, the women do cooking for days, and everybody, you know, guys sit around and talk, and the women sit around and talk, and they go away, and everybody's just exhausted because of the fact that most of the work was done by a handful of the people. Everybody didn't come there to enrich the people who were opening their doors and their place to the people. The Levites were supposed to, after these festivals, they were supposed to have enough extra funds to get them through to the next festival, doing the job of the daily ministration to the people. This was to be a time of great blessing. You'll find this even in Indian tribes did this. And, I mean, the whole five nation thing, which sometimes they call it seven nations, you know, back east, they had festivals, and everybody would come to the festival and, you know, bury the hatchet, so to speak. We wouldn't have any feuds, and we'd have councils, and we would bring everything you possibly could to share. We have kind of remnants of that came out of Thanksgiving. Those were events where people knew they had to share with one another, not just on one day of the week, but or one day of the year, but throughout the year. This was a celebration point to mark that, but then they would have to share throughout the year. But they did it with free will offerings. Very important. So anyway, we're going to talk a little bit more about exactly what this art of not being governed. All these people for thousands of years, according to James Scott, has been escaping the ill effects of centralized government. And of course, you can go to Samuel 8 and read what that is. But there's actually a lot more. We'll talk a little bit about that too when we return. But first, we're going to take a little break, and then we'll be right back, and we'll tell you some more about the art of not being governed. We'll be right back. Okay, so we were talking about this book by James C. Scott, The Art of Not Being Governed, which is actually an anarchist history of the upland Southeast Asia area called Zomia, the Zomia Highlands of Southeast Asia, which occupies on the map at least seven different Asian countries. And it's full of these people who don't want to be a part of government because of the ill effects of government. There are some good things that come out of government, obviously, but there are some ill effects that come out of government. You know, this idea of centralized government, and we try lots of different kinds of them. And what happens is that people become more and more dependent upon the government, and they begin to overlook some of those ill effects, which are listed as slavery, conscription, taxes, corvée. Like I said, he's one of the few people that mentioned corvée, which is actually a French word, but it has to do with statutory labor, where a portion of your labor every year has to be given to the government. And of course, this was the bondage of Egypt, was actually based on a corvée system of statutory labor. We always talk about the bondage in Egypt as some sort of slavery, like the Israelites were slaves in Egypt. No, they weren't slaves in Egypt. They were a part of a corvée. There was very little slavery in Egypt because they didn't really need slavery as such in Egypt because they had the corvée. They had everybody in society, except for the priests of society, had to work one-fifth of the year for the government. Now, they could go and actually work off for a month or two or three that obligation, or they could send funds, or they actually, in some cases, some men actually spent their life working for the government in replace of other people. So what they would do is somebody, they didn't want to go work for the government, so they would pay the salaries of this individual who worked for the government. And he would pay it for one-fifth of the year. And then somebody else would pay his salary for another fifth out of the year. And somebody else would pay his salary for another fifth out of the year. Now, I think they actually did it where they'd pay a fifth of his salary year-round. And actually, we do all that today. We just do it through income tax. You know, everybody pays in the income tax, and then that money's supposed to go to the government to pay for all the government benefits. Problem is that just like in the days of Nero, everybody's overspent it. So what they do now is they borrow against the future, which is another violation of the Ten Commandments. They borrow against, they don't earn their day of rest. They don't earn what they're going to get, their benefit. They borrow against the future to provide the benefit today with the intention of paying it back tomorrow. Well, tomorrow you're going to be dead. So your children will have to pay it back. So what's happening is through our covetous practices, we are making merchandise of our children. And so we're in a corvée system here in the United States. They are in Canada. They are in Australia. They are in England. They are in St. Croix. They are in Santo Domingo. But in all these places, there are people who don't want to be a part of that system for a variety of reasons. And like I say, one is they don't like the slavery. They feel like the state has made them a slave. They don't like the conscription. They don't like the taxes. They don't like the corvée. Well, those are really all the same thing. Corvée is a tax. It makes slaves of the people. It's conscripting the people to perform tasks for the people. That's why you have these taskmasters with federal employee identification numbers, and you're working for them, and they take a portion of your wages, and you never see it. They just take it away, and they send it off to somebody else. And it feels somewhat painless, but yet you still feel that sting somewhere down the line, but you don't feel it all at once. You don't actually have a guy kicking in your door on a daily basis to take food off of your table. But they are taking food off of your table. They're taking resources away from you. And it's just done in a very clever way. And it's legal. I'm not saying it's that you should rebel against this system, because you need that system. If you don't have those police in place and the fire departments in place and the courts in place, you will have total chaos in this country. You will have riots like Ferguson all over the whole country. So you need that in place. Why? Because you don't know the art of not being governed. You don't know how to live without the state. People always want, how do you get out of the state? How do you get out of the system? You're not ready. You can't handle freedom. I mean, you personally, you might be young and strong and healthy and you can do it, but how do you take care of your family? Give you a picture. Now, I just saw this. I went to Facebook. I had a few minutes before the show. I went to Facebook and glancing down real quick, and I watched a couple of videos, and there was some young blonde woman in front of an auditorium, evidently outside the glass doors, and there were all these people protesting. I guess it was anti-Trump people or something protesting, and she was there, and they threw eggs at her, spit at her, threw tomatoes at her. She's just a young woman standing there. And there's all these men around, some holding up Mexican flags, and they're yelling and screaming. These guys did not turn around and said, who threw that? Don't do that. Why are you doing that to this woman? She's just a young... I mean, how callous can you get? How brutal can you get? She wasn't holding up big protest signs. She wasn't attacking anybody, but they were egging her and throwing vegetables at her. I guess it looked like a tomato. I don't know what it was. And hitting her pretty hard. And she was taking it with a smile. I was impressed. But with the men there, and there were probably women in the crowd. I just saw men up front. I wasn't there or anything. It's just a video. It was just appalling. That would have never been allowed in America years ago. But being a socialist nation now for, 50, 60 years, we've turned into that. We don't know how to treat one another with respect. And we're bringing in people from all over the world that have the spirit, but we aren't protecting one another. Because, and I've talked about, I have people in Sweden and I'm very fond of, but they are being taken over and destroyed. And that's possible in the land of the Vikings because they've allowed themselves to become a socialist nation. Now, unfortunately, the backlash to this is probably going to be more in the line of Nazism and fascism. And there's going to be a race war throughout Europe that is going to be devastating to Europe. You can see that going. Now, like I said, there's always been people for a variety of reasons who want to escape the epidemics and the warfare and the conscription and the taxes that come with the Samuel 8 type governments when you give men power. And I quoted from a question where it says, where a guy was actually admiring the fact, thought it was great that someone was able to take away from one class of citizens to provide education for another class. He says this is a benefit of government, that someone is willing to extract resources from one group and spend it, for example, on teaching kids to read. Well, you could do that without an authoritarian government. You could do that voluntarily. And this is what the early church was doing. They weren't, people were, you can teach your kids to read. People want to get, the government out of their schools. Well, let's get out of their government schools. I mean, home taught. But when you home teach, if you home teach one at a time and individually, you become vulnerable. How do you gather together? Well, you get in homeschooling clubs and where it's voluntary, where you can leave anytime you want. You're not pooling all your efforts, but you can at times pool your resources, trade books, trade curriculums, learn how to do this. And we didn't know what we were doing when we were homeschooling. But in that process, you begin to learn to see who you can trust, who is diligent, has the social virtues. You see, because Christ was showing people how to come out of the world and how to, the art of not being governed by the world. You were to live in the world, but not of the world. Well, the reason you're governed by the world is because you've looked to these benefactors who exercise authority, and they get to exercise authority over you. But you can educate your children. You can create health care. We've talked about health shares. the Samaritan, you know, Good Samaritan system, which is not bad, but you could do the same thing better, more efficiently, if you gather together in these tens, hundreds, and thousand congregations. You're still home churching, but you're not forsaking the gathering together. Forsaking the gathering together doesn't mean, well, we got together with nine other guys in our home church, and so we gathered together. We didn't forsake the gathering together. Yeah, you did. If that's all you did, if you only get together with your nine other guys, then you're not preaching the kingdom. You're just preaching home church. The kingdom was networking hundreds of thousands of people all across Europe. That we'd come to each other's aid, we'd give shelter to each other, would help each other. During the persecutions, the Christians were thriving because they understood the whole gospel. They understood the art of not being governed by Rome. Now, Rome began to hate this. And they tried to defeat them, they would arrest their bishops. And that was another thing. We've talked a great deal about what this word bishop is. I can tell you the first century bishop was nothing, absolutely nothing, like what you now see posing as bishops today in your Episcopalian or Catholic or any of these churches that have bishops. Those first century bishops, which was episcopo, was the actual Greek word, and there's, I think it's pakwe in the Hebrew. Their job was nothing like what you see bishops do today. They had a daily ministration. No Christian had to go to the benefactors who exercise authority. No Christian had to go to the conscripted patres, the conscripted fathers of the nations. Because, see, that's how they get control over you. And that's another web page that we created this last couple of weeks and has been improved on and is ready for publication. Join the network. Go to our preparingyou.com. Go to hisholychurch.org and join the network in your local area. We had somebody wanting to join in Romania. Okay, we have an area that covers Romania in Europe. He knows people. They want to form a congregation. And it's very important to start doing this in a variety of areas, because one of the things that James Scott talks about, just briefly, but talks about, is that since, 1950s, it's certainly 1945s, all these people throughout the world, including Romania and Bulgaria, and, I was giving examples of Santo Domingo and Malaysia, there's a whole group of people that are not a part of the government. They still pay a certain amount of excise and tariff taxes as they go around through Malaysia, but they're actually separate from and they have their own government. Well, a government has to be back to the law of the place, which I mentioned with Pompeii. You have to have this law of the place. So you have to have places, physical places, somewhere, where you can meet that is not a part of the state, that is separate from the state. Well, you used to be able to do that in the churches, because the church was separate from the state. But today, that's not so. I mean, in countries like Norway, basically, the Lutheran Church is a part of the state. Now, the United States, they still say that church is separate from the state. Everybody wants to say that. But the reality is they make it very difficult for a church who does not incorporate under the United States government through one of the states. You have to incorporate one of the states. Well, the reality is you read the laws in the states. It says if you incorporate under the laws of the state of whatever, Illinois, all other previous incorporation is null and void as if it never happened. Well, the church is supposed to be incorporated by Christ. In order to protect that, you have to follow certain patterns. If you're going to follow Christ, you have to follow certain patterns. You have to stop coveting your neighbor's goods. You have to start loving your neighbor as yourself. You have to love each other, but you also have to take care of your family. You love each other and love your neighbor and even the stranger in your midst and even your enemies. If you could do that, you would know the art of not being governed. Now, the government's not going to go away. It's going to probably persecute real Christians. It's going to persecute even the fake Christians, you know, the modern Christians who aren't really doing what Christ said. They're going to get persecuted too, just for mentioning his name. But the problem with them is Christ is not going to come to their aid, because they're actually still workers of iniquity, claiming to follow Christ, but they're not actually doing what he said. They're saying, Lord, Lord, but they're not doers of the word. And therefore, they make the word of God to none effect. So therefore, when their hour of need comes, he's just going to say, get ye from me, I know you not. Now, real Christians who are actually coming together with a desire to love one another, to keep the Sabbath, not the seventh day, but the idea of paying as you go, earning your right to be separate, earning your right to take your day of rest, because you actually you invested in the kingdom of God. You invested yourself and your time with free will offerings. You start to become able and capable and skilled enough to survive without the government. And there's a multitude of skills that you could learn. Like Thule reads. Locally a family is going to be going out. I already know a lot of this, but I'm sure there are things they will pick up and find out how you harvest Thule reeds. Well, there's 7,000 acres of Thule reeds in this valley alone. That could sustain you. Well, we don't want to go back to that primitive lifestyle. We also learning how to make equipment, and how we have a radio network that isn't dependent upon, you know, the internet to survive. They can connect one another through the, you know, shortwave and other forms of private radio broadcasting, and they're learning the skills to do that. And so there's survival food, gardening, growing your own seeds, health. There are all kinds of alternatives. If you were in a natural health, actually what you do is you just form a congregation. We connect you with all the other congregations, and there will be people in that congregation. Some will be wheat farmers, some will be orchard and vineyard keepers, some will be health, absolute health nuts. They know everything about health. Or the essential oils. What essential oils? They know that some of the essential oils are devastating to cancer and really help cancer victims. Changing your diet. There are people who know that. Homeschooling. We still haven't put together our symposium on homeschooling, but we will do that. We will get to that. We need more workers. Everybody seeking the kingdom of God should come together and a network, and everybody works, no exceptions. Now, that was a rule that, you know, that was a statement we heard in a movie during the Holocaust in World War II, where people who were separate, including the gypsies and anybody who didn't want to be a part of the society. That's where James Scott mentions 1945. After 1945, you had to, just to travel, you had to profess yourself subject to one government or another. Before 1945, you didn't have to be a citizen of any government. You could travel from country to country. That was easily done. Done all the time by thousands of people called internationals. All the gypsies did this all the time. Many of the Jews did this all the time. They were not, you know, back to the thing with Pompey and Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. They couldn't make treaties, and to apply for a passport, you're making a treaty, a personal family treaty, where you're subject, and you could be put into a workforce. This is actually in the laws. We show you this. It's actually in the statutory laws of the United States. If you have a passport, I don't care how you got it, the law says that they can conscript you into a labor force without any complaint at any time they want. And now, those laws didn't used to exist. They do now. Because there is no place you can... One of the topics I saw going through the network, you can run, but you can't hide. If you actually follow Christ, you won't have to hide. And if you did have to hide, you'd have a place to go. Because you have a whole network of people that reaches all across this country and the next country where you can go. You know, you could go from nation to nation. And there would be people to accept you there and guide you around in that nation and help you and house you and protect you. And they would do it because they love you. Because those are real Christians. Now, there's a lot of modern Christians who aren't really following Christ, who have need of repentance. And in the days to come, they will have their opportunity to repent. When the wrath of God, or the wrath of whatever that means, and I could explain all that, but we don't have enough time, comes upon your nation and all nations, you will get a chance to learn the art of not being governed, but the actual art of being governed in your hearts and in your mind by God. And there will be an awakening. You will see things that you did not see before. They tell you this. This is part of the prophecy of the Bible. It's actually going on right now. That there, you know, and I don't want to get too much in the metaphysical element of this. If you start following this idea, what Abraham was doing, what he was really doing, and you go to the Jews today, they won't be able to tell you what Abraham was really doing. They won't be able to even tell you what Moses was doing. But if you go to the Christians today, they can't tell you what Christ was doing. We tell you, we show you, we write books about it, we put up web pages with details, with footnotes, live links to other articles that take you through this step by step. We have a whole network of people that will help explain this to you and show. We welcome people who don't get it, who want to get it. Because every time you ask these pertinent questions, we were able to create better and better answers. With more detailed explanations and link it to other things that you're missing. They have been weakening you by keeping the truth from you. It's the truth that will set you free. But you can't settle like Larkin Rose does for half of the truth. You got to be willing to settle for the whole truth. And what will that look like? It will look like people coming together, not just caring about your family, not just caring about your neighbor right next door, but caring about a whole network of people, many that you've never even met. Because you will not get grace. What grace have you if you only love those who love you? You must love a broad network of people, even the strangers who are not really in your network, and even your enemy. And then there is this grace, this awakening, that will show you things that have been secret from time immemorial. And you will become prepared to live without the government. Because the government's going to collapse. It's the unrighteous mammon. It's going to collapse. Eventually, I don't know, could be 30 years from now. I hope it is. Because you need that much time. You may not have that much time. It could be 3 years from now. It could be 3 months from now. But in the meantime, this will be life-altering to seek that kingdom of God and His righteousness. Don't just seek to be separate. Seek to be a part of the righteousness of Christ. And it will change you. It will awaken you. It will awaken things in you you didn't even know existed. And you will become prepared for freedom. And until then, may peace be upon your house, and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.